This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Trapped by a Dream, When Fates Collide. A true account taken from the journals of Boots Butler, and the author is Leola Butler, and she joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, and this interview is brought to you by Author Hive Publications. Hello, Leola.
Hi, Steve.
Good to have you with us. This is a very gut-wrenching kind of read. We're talking about child abduction, child slavery. This is a very tough to deal with, and yet it's going on at a terrible epidemic rate, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's gone beyond the global. There are no global confines on this. Every country in the world it has this problem, ours included.
Well, let me read a few things you've written about your book just to set the general theme of this interview. You say, Trapped by a Dream, When Fates Collide is a true account of the rescue mission of a young Russian girl who had been abducted and trafficked to a house of prostitution in Amsterdam. The story is taken from the journals of Boots Butler while he was working under the nonprofit child recovery organization Somewhere Out There. Boots was the team leader and head investigator for this recovery mission, aided by an extraordinary group of comrades. The story is told in a narrative form from Boots' perspective. And we can add to that, you're his wife.
Yes, I am, for 36 years now.
And work very closely with him. And so certainly understand what Somewhere Out There is all about and what this story is all about.
Yes, I've been the secretary and treasurer for, and the case assignment manager for Somewhere Out There for the last 17 years.
And this is a series. This is the first in a series that you're writing. Why are you putting this together?
The reason why I'm putting this series together, first of all, Boots has written journals all of his life. Every extraordinary thing that has happened in his life is written down. And as I read, he had me read his journals, I thought, these are stories that people should know. People should know that these things are happening in the world. And also, as a tribute to not only Boots, but to his comrades, and the wonderful men and women who have gone above and beyond to help in these child rescues.
Well, let's talk about this one story, this first one, which deals with this Russian girl. Tell us about Svetlana.
Well, she is from a very poor, she was from a very poor area in Russia. She thought that she could get legitimate employment, hopefully as a nanny. And so she innocently applied to a company that she thought was legitimate. After her indoctrination and everything, they drugged her. It was a front company. And they drugged her, and she was transported to Amsterdam, where she was held as a prostitute, forced into prostitution.
For how long?
It was about 16 months total captivity. And when she first went over, she was not even 18 years old yet. So we're talking a 17-year-old child being forced into prostitution.
Now, how did this come to your attention, the attention of Boots and yourself and the organization?
Actually, it was through a mutual friend who had worked on a case before. This was a shoestring relative of hers. And it was her family here in the United States that contacted Somewhere Out There.
Child sexual exploitation is a monumental tragedy. Tell us, put that in perspective for us.
Well, when you look at it worldwide, okay, there are 2.5 million children that are being trafficked each year in the world. The majority of these children are held for slaves, as slaves for sexual exploitation. We look at other countries, like I can give you an example. Cambodia has 30,000 known child prostitutes. Some of these kids are as young as 5 years old. They're groomed as babies, and so they don't even realize that all they've known all their life is sexual exploitation. They don't realize that it's wrong. India has the largest concentration of child prostitutes. A lot of those from India are the children of sex workers. And so it just goes on, generation after generation. But there is no place in the world where children are not either trafficked into or out of or both.
We're talking about billions of dollars, this kind of just tragic industry.
Right. You're talking about a $12 billion a year industry. The only worldwide industry that even rivals child trafficking is the illegal drug traffic. That is the only crime worldwide that rivals child trafficking. And unfortunately, the child trafficking is rising by leaps and bounds.
So this first book in this series about Svetlana and how she was rescued, and it has an incredible ending. We're not going to talk about it, but
right. It was a definite success story.
Yeah, monumental ending. This was taken from his journal, so this is in the first person from Boots's perspective, and just accounts of the day-to-day process of getting Svetlana back.
Yes, that's correct.
What drives these people? What drives your husband and the others that work with them?
Well, you know, each of them have.
I mean, they're probably not all success stories we're dealing with here.
No, unfortunately, they are not. Sometimes it's just, you know, they want the parents to have closure. I mean, and unfortunately, yes, we have found bodies. Not always are the children that we've found returned back to the parents, because many times they have come from abusive situations. But each of the members of the teams that go out, they have their own reasons. Now, Boots has been a child advocate all of his life. He's always had that special place for children. And he has what I call the Sir Galahad complex. If there's somebody to be saved, he's the one that feels that he can do it. And where there's a will, there's a way. Our motto is, failure is not an option.
Right. And that could even mean death along the way.
It very well could be. These men and women, Boots included, each time they go out, they put their lives on the line. They go into very, very dangerous situations, organized crime syndicates, and accost pimps, and they do what they have to do to get these children out of the bad situations. Now, a lot of people call that vigilante justice. But if we don't get involved, then what happens to the children? What happens to our future?
Well, in this case, he had to deal with the Russian mafia.
Yes, he did, which he's dealt with before, too. So he knew how devastating they can be, how unconscionable they can be. They don't you know, they don't care about human dignity. They don't care about human rights at all.
It's just all about money and probably power.
That's it. It comes down to the dollars and cents.
Yeah, money and power, right?
Mm-hmm.
What seems to be the most difficult obstacles in this kind of a crusade?
Actually, the most difficult obstacles, well, there's two. The first is money. In this particular case, there was a wealthy relative that basically money wasn't a problem on this one. But usually that's what it is money, you know, because you have plane tickets, you have investigations, you have transported the child back home, so depending on where they are in the country or in the world. And then our second problem has to do with dealing with local law enforcement, unfortunately. And the problems that we
have to pay them off. You have to pay them off.
Private organization. That is why Somewhere Out There was originally started. Was because of the group of citizens that were searching for a child, and the lack of local. Oh gosh, I'm trying to think of the word. Cooperation. Because of the lack of local cooperation.
Do you often have to pay bribes or come up with ransom money?
We have paid bribes. We have bought illegal papers. We have bought illegal passports. Yeah, bribes, especially in other countries, is a common thing. Very, very common.
So whatever it takes to get the job done, it's
whatever it takes.
You know, and as you put it before,
is failure is not an option.
That says it all, I guess, doesn't it? That
I think so.
That says it all. My goodness, who is it most at risk in this kind of dangerous activity?
The one who is always the most at risk is the child. Usually, the predator who has them, they don't care enough about them whether they live or die. And that's not including the psychological damage of not only the abduction and the captivity, but of the rescue itself. Sometimes there's gunfire and violent situations to get these kids out, and that's a trauma also.
Now, you have some advice for parents and family of how to protect your children from such a terrible exploitation. I guess, you know, you hear something like this, and all of a sudden, as a parent, a grandparent like myself, you're going to be, you know, when you're with your kids or your grandkids, you're going to be looking over your shoulder.
Right, right. And most of us do. I'm a grandparent also. But it seems like every time we pick up the newspaper, there's national headlines about children being abducted. And so, of course, yes, the majority of us want to protect our children from predators. And so there's a few things that parents can do that are just so easy. The first thing I'd say is never, never, never leave your child unattended in a car or a stroller. You know, a lot of parents do that. They run into the grocery, they got their little one in the car seat, and they leave them there with the car running. Child predators are creatures of opportunity. Do not be the one to give them that opportunity. Okay. I would also say to choose your child's caregivers very carefully. When you're employing your daycare providers, your nannies, your babysitters, always check the references. Always. You never know in this day and age, and that's what predators do. The child predators put themselves in positions to be around children. That way they can victimize at will. So choose those caregivers very, very carefully. And the other thing is teach your children. We teach our little children that they're supposed to respect their elders and always be polite, not scream and yell. But at the same time, we need to teach our kids that if someone tries to accost them, if someone they know touches them in a way that they don't feel comfortable about it, go with that gut instinct that it's okay. They can kick, they can scream, they can run away, whatever it takes, that they can do that. Get away from that situation. If it comes to find out it wasn't a dangerous situation, well, wonderful. But it could save their life.
Leola, tell us how to get your book.
You can get my book at Ex Libris, which is my publisher. And the website for that is www.trappedbyadream.com. And you can also, there's a link on my website, which is www.bootsbooksbyleolabutler.com.
Well, we really appreciate you being with us on this Indie Book Publishing Show, brought to you by Author Hive Publications. Thank you, Leola.
And thank you, Steve.
That was Leola Butler. She is the author of Trapped by a Dream, When Fates Collide, a true account taken from the journals of Boots Butler.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Get ready for the Not-So-Soccer Mom, Tuesday afternoons at 1 Eastern, noon Central, on TogiNet with Jill Hickey. You name it, from politics to pop culture to Jill's search for the perfect bronzer and chicken salad. The Not-So-Soccer Mom will weigh in on it all. The sentence, "I have no opinion about that," is one that Jill has never uttered. In the early 90s, Jill finally decided to put her thoughts, opinions, mom advice, love of pop culture, hummus, and Starbucks, working out, cosmetic shopping, and politics into an actual website, and thus NotSoSoccerMom.com was born. Shortly after her fourth child, a boy, Jerome, now she's really got tons of topics to share with you. This is Laugh Out Loud Funny, and we're not kidding. What's a loud Nebraska girl who lived in Little Rock for many years and now is up in the Northeast doing? Chronicling her opinions on everything. The wheels aren't off yet, but it's close. It's the Not-So-Soccer Mom with Jill Hickey, Tuesday afternoons at 1 Eastern, noon Central, on TogiNet.com. Innovation and insight. Problems and solutions. Capitalizing on your ideas and efforts. That's all a part of Changing the World, One Invention at a Time, with Rick Rowe. Thursday evenings at 6, 5 Central, on TogiNet.com. Rick will be sharing stories of innovation, invention, inspiration, and overcoming obstacles with guests who have been there, done that, and are doing that. Rick will be asking the right questions, helping you identify the real problems, and showing you how to act on your ideas by increasing consumer confidence, and more importantly, increasing your confidence to act on your ideas. For even more information, go to ThinkTech, that's T-E-K, globally.com. Then join us as Rick and his guests teach us how to develop new ideas and create new products, new businesses, new jobs. And together, let's get our economy growing again. It's Changing the World, One Invention at a Time, with author and inventor Rick Rowe. Thursday evenings at 6, 5 Central, on TogiNet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Barely Exposed, and the author and photographer is Latana, and we welcome Latana to this special interview on Indie Book Publishing, brought to you by Author Hive Publication. Hello, Latana.
Hello.
Well, it's a thrill to talk to you, talking from Texas all the way to Singapore. This is, again, technology is amazing, isn't it?
It certainly is, yeah.
Well, let me read a few things that you have written about Barely Exposed to give everyone a general idea of what we're talking about. You say this, Barely Exposed explores the visual realm of 60 young adults, geographically and ethnically diverse in background. The images and responses come from various places in the world. It is interesting to find out how someone sees their world coming from California compared to someone coming from Cairo, Egypt. You also say this, Barely Exposed is a photographic book which captures the thoughts of 60 young adults from all over the world who are passing into adulthood, ages 17 to 21. Their fears, hopes, and dreams are seen in their contemplative portraits and written in their own words on how they see their world. Well, first, tell us about your background, Latana. You're a very accomplished photographer. You've been doing this for 20 years. Tell us about your background.
Well, I started photography and fashion in New York. And when I married and went to California, I decided to start doing fine art. And continued doing that for a number of years until I started traveling and found a way of being able to continue my work while I was raising a family and traveling with my husband, actually, is what happened. So it made it easy for me to go to different areas and try to find projects and work.
So your career in fashion photography, you've worked with many magazines like Harper's and Vogue.
I worked with a few magazines. I did catalogs. I did anything that I could do at that point to make a living. But I was much happier doing fine art. So the minute I could proceed and do something different, I immediately did. And that was when I moved to California.
Barely Exposed, as you say, explores the visual realm of these 60 young adults. Now, they're all shot half-dressed against a black background. Now, why did you do that? What was the purpose in that technique?
It was important for me to try to get to the essence of who these young adults were as individuals, and not that they would be hiding behind their clothing I find that when you ask someone to undress or to bare themselves or expose themselves, there's a certain vulnerability and it becomes not where they come from or how they look, but it's really who they are. And that was so important to me, to see what the person was as in trying to capture their portrait. What they had to say.
And these 60 young adults, they're from how many different countries?
I haven't counted exactly how many, but they're from Asia, from the Middle East, from Russia, China, many in the United States, of course, in Europe. And of course, you're not going to ask, or you can ask, but there will be a number of these people in certainly certain cultures, like in the Muslim countries, where they're not going to want to bare themselves physically. So when that was not possible, then I would get very close and try to do the portrait and only use the face. And what I found, which I found to be very interesting, was that vulnerability that I found in the West when people were half-dressed. I found that same vulnerability in the eyes of other young adults in those other countries.
So you're trying to find out what these young people think at this time in their life, and according to their background, their culture, and their country, and also to understand how they fit in. Is that it? You know, because adults...
Yeah, how they fit in, yeah, exactly. How they fit in and how they feel they fit in, not how we see how they fit in, but how they feel they fit in, and do they fit in? And are they comfortable in their skin? And are they comfortable where they are? Yeah.
Now, young people have probably same kinds of hopes and dreams?
Most of them do. But it's very interesting to see that most of them are very similar.
But there is a difference, I find, when you speak to the same age group in the West and in the East. There's a marked difference in how they think, and as far as religion, as far as the family.
How did they respond to you when you asked them to undress this half-naked kind of format, this theme in your book?
Well, in the West, I didn't have any problem. I didn't have any problem with any of the young people from California, from Europe. I didn't have any problems at all. When you go obviously to the Middle East, you know that that's not going to be possible. And then when I went to China, that was not possible. And in India, not possible. So, you know, those areas where I knew I couldn't, that I had to address it differently.
Some may say that having them be half undressed like this just kind of takes it into the sexual realm of, and would be critical of you.
Absolutely not sexual at all. And once you delve into the book, you see that it has nothing to do with sexuality. It has nothing to do with sexuality. There is nothing sexual about the portraits. There is nothing sexual about how they stand or how they show themselves. It's, you know, many of the girls are covered because that's who they are. They were allowed to. I never asked them to pose any differently. The only thing that I asked them was that they looked directly into the camera. But when you do, when you have that, and barely exposed, by the way. Barely exposed has to do not only with the if you see the cover of the book that looks like a Polaroid that's barely exposed, but it has to do with what they have to say, which is just minimal. They're bearing their souls as much as they can, but they don't know they have that much. But they're saying what they can say in that short amount of time, and barely exposed in how they're dressed, but. Everything about the images of those young adults is more vulnerability than sexual.
And in some of these statements, which, like you say, are fairly short, some of them are a little longer, but then there's also the actual foreign language translation as well, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So you have both English, and then in some you have the language of where they're from.
Oh, well, the language of what they spoke, because if they didn't speak English, I wouldn't. They wrote in their language.
Ah, all right. So they spoke in their own language, and then.
Oh yeah.
Obviously,
mm-hmm.
You translated.
And then I had it translated
into
course.
English, right? Okay, because I see, you know, just leafing through this. I mean, here's Korea, here's Tahitian.
Right.
There's Switzerland, I mean, Turkey, California, you know, how did you choose these young people? How was that process? How did you do that?
Well, I have to be honest, when I would be traveling and I had two days where I had to find someone, if I was in a hotel, I would go and start asking if there were any 17 to 21 year olds. And for instance, when I was in Russia, I was lucky enough to have a mother who said, oh, my son is just coming out of school at 3:00. Would you like to, I'm sure he would be interested in being part of the project. And then he would come and I would carry my portable studio with me and I would put up my curtain and take the photograph and they would then sit down and write their response. So I really didn't choose and pick. I randomly, I had to use the luck of the draw. But I never picked the best or the best looking or the richest or the poorest. I just picked whatever I could from that country and see what came of it.
Well, I see here, just again leafing through the photographs, here's a young lady from the Philippines, and she mm-hmm. didn't bear her
no.
She's not half-dressed.
No, she's not.
Yes.
No, she's not. She's a Muslim.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And, of course, as you would expect, the photograph of this young man from Texas, He is bare-chested, but he is wearing a Texas cowboy hat.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. That's making a statement by itself, right? What did you get out of their statements? What did it mean to you?
You know, I don't know if you know that one of the reasons that one of my inspirations for the book was the fact that my son was coming to this age, and as a parent, I started realizing how I was no longer in control of this child who is now becoming a man, and wondering how what was he thinking, what were the fears that he would have, what was he thinking of the future. You start seeing this child grow into a man, as a parent, you see a child becoming a stranger because it's no longer the person that you knew. And it interested me to see if this was just the age group, or if they all thought the same way, or if was I so different, or is my child so different, or are we all the same, or do we all go through the same process? And it just became, asking him the question, and then going on to his friends, and then continuing the project.
You make this statement.
And as you said before, you know, what is the realization? What did I come to realize was that, they're not so different. All over the world, we're not so different. I think every parent goes through it. Every child has to go through that age where they feel that they're not being heard, and we as parents have to maybe realize that.
Not being heard, and also, as you put it, not taken seriously.
And not taken seriously because they're not young enough, and they're not old enough, and they're in the state of limbo. And I think that's the sense I got from most of them, is that they really didn't know where they were. They had no, they felt that it was just an age group where there's so many questions, there's so many fears that are coming up, and they really don't know how to address it.
Was there a criteria that you used to choose the photographs for your book? Did you take a whole lot more than you put into the book?
I allowed them to choose their photographs. Everyone chose the photographs themselves, so that it would be not only how they saw their world, but how do they see themselves. I thought that was also very important.
And did you find religion or spirituality to be important in their lives?
I found that to be very important in the lives of these young adults from places like the Philippines, like Indonesia, like Colombia, where else? I would say from the East much more than the West. Spirituality took a very important part of their lives. Yes.
Any concluding thoughts, Latana?
I think having done this book and now sort of being very introspective as to why, and I've been asked so often why and what did I get from it, I would love for other parents and parents who are maybe going to have their children reach this age group to understand and to open their minds and their hearts to their children and really, really see how fragile they can be at this time in their lives and the needs that they have to be heard.
Tell us how to get your book, Latana.
Well, Amazon is one way to get it. Just have to punch in Barely Exposed, or you can get it directly from me on my website.
And your website, give us that.
LatanaStudio.com.
Latana, LatanaStudio.com.
studio.com. That's it.
Well, we appreciate you being with us on Indie Book Publishing. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Latana. She is the publisher. That was Latana. She is the author and photographer of her book, Barely Exposed. And this special interview on Indie Book Publishing is brought to you by AuthorHive Publication.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Mark Lipinski is coming to TogiNet. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, a live two-hour show Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on TogiNet.com. Creative Mojo. It's fun, entertaining, informative, inspirational, and illuminating. Lipinski has worked on such shows as Oprah, The View, The Joan Rivers Show, and Ricky Lake. He's busy, but he's got the drive to share with Creative Mojo, dedicated to the modern crafter and crafting lifestyle. Dive into the info and enjoy everything from celebs to entertainment news to recipes, quilting and needlework, knitting, painting, woodworking, Christmas crafts, and so much more. This show boldly encourages you to discover and harness your own creative spirit by living creatively every day. For more on Mark and the show, check out marklipinski.com. Don't miss the fun. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on toginet.com.
Youth was sad, right? Cause he had a death kill mommy and dad, right? But that ain't the case, nope. It wasn't his fate, no, nope. The ones never struggled to communicate, ha. Y'all wave your hands, look who's on, yeah. It's Dakota Man Keith, and he's number one.
It's That Keith Wan Show on TogiNet.com, Wednesday nights at 8, 7 Central. Every week, That Keith Wan Show will have guests that share their experiences, expertise, opinions, and personal lives with us to hopefully help us better understand others. The topics and guests will come from the American Sign Language community. For more on Keith Wan and the show, go to his website, KeithWan.com. Listen with an open mind and willingness to learn and help with the cultural bridge.
Number one, Keith's number one. Everybody clap because the Dakota Man's on. Number one, Keith's number one. Everybody clap because the Dakota Man's on.
Don't miss That Keith Wan Show. Wednesday nights at 8, 7 Central on TogiNet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Ashes, and the author is Audrey Payton. And she joins us now on Indie Book Publishing. This interview is brought to you by AuthorHive Publication. Hello, Audrey.
Hello there, Steve.
Ashes, a thriller, a heart stopper, a lot of twists and turns. This is what you've written about your story. A radio bulletin reveals the world is slowly being reduced to ashes. Life vanishes from planet Earth, including plant life. Who committed such evil? What were their means? Answers come too soon for three survivors when evil, greed, and brutality disrupt the peace they've established on a tranquil Pacific island. Well, I guess that has every bit of intrigue, drama, and mystery, and the end of the world, right?
Right, that's it, yes.
What motivated you to write this book?
Well, I was raised in London during the Blitz, the war, World War II Blitz, and it was terrifying for 6 years. And I really expected the whole world, to come to an end because I'd, you know, heard grown-ups talking, this is the World War, the Americans are in it, the Australians, and so on and so on. And I thought the whole world would come to an end because I thought that Hitler, who wanted to rule the world, was so powerful and terrifying a person that he would manage to do it. So I had this, it was buried deep in my psyche, that the world was going to end. And it came out one day when I sat... I had been writing some trivial little romances, and then I had this come into my head about the world coming to an end. And I suppose maybe as a child I pictured it all being ashes, but I can't, the title came to me very quickly. And I started writing it, but didn't get very far. I think I did three chapters and then knew I was not competent a writer. To go ahead. And so I put the chapters away and went to creative writing classes for over 6 years, actually 10 years. But after 6 years of creative writing classes, I continued with the novel, with the chapters. I brought them out and I
I was a lot better at writing then, at writing fiction.
One of the characters, the main characters, is named Kit. Tell us about Kit.
That's right. She's, when this the disaster happens, she has been selfish enough to send her husband and 8-year-old son, I think he is, off to the mountains by themselves without her. She didn't want to go. She thought it was going to be a drag. This is in California, the mountains being San Jacinto Mountains. And so she left, and they lived in a house that had a shelter in the basement, and she loved seclusion. She was very selfish, very racist, and very vain. She was beautiful. And she went down into the shelter to be quiet for a while with her dog, Rusty. And then the husband had gotten a permit for a transmitter, which she turned on the television she had on, and it said, if you have a transmitter or private radio, turn it on. This is an emergency. And she did, and then learned that the world was coming to an end. She didn't believe it at first. And then she had to stay 100 days in the shelter, surviving. There were survival supplies, plenty of canned food and vitamins, sleeping pills, lots and lots of water, and lots of oxygen and dog food. The person who had originally built the shelter had thought of absolutely everything, and then he died. So anyway, the shelter wasn't needed by that person. But she did survive 100 days, earthquake and all. And then she leaves the shelter and finds the world has turned to ashes. Human beings, plant life, everything, it's all ashes. And she meets her mother, who did live on the beach. She goes to the beach and finds her mother crumbling in an armchair. And then she goes outside to call her dog. This is Kit. I'm saying she all the time. And the poison, the stuff that had caused this destruction, was burning her eyes, so her eyes were just a haze. And she runs outside. She's at a beach, and she sees two people coming toward her, and it's a man and a boy. She thinks it's her husband and son, and she runs towards them, and then she falls in a dead faint. And then the child says, "Don't touch her, Ellen." This is another character that comes in. She's been near those ashes. And then the reader is opened up to that's what the ashes is. And the character, Alan, I alternate characters in this book. Kit, it begins with Kit, and then there's Alan, then Kit, then Alan, and all the way through the novel. And then at the end, it's Kit and Alan, because they're together at last. And except only nobody knows who's done this terrible thing. The whole world has been affected. And they don't know how or who or why. And they join forces, all of them, and Kit is still terribly vain and selfish and only uses Alan and the little girl, who's a little black girl named Della. She's central to the novel. And they join forces. They pick out a beautiful, stunning beach house and live in it. And Alan is slowly falling in love with Kit, and she hates him. And he does everything he can to make her happy. And he thinks, so he and his father had built a boat when he was a kid. And he goes to Sears and gets a generator. And at last they have electricity in the house. And and then they're able to really not cook, but open cans of food and eat. And he grows vegetables because there's rain and the green is coming back in the mountains. And on the garden, not a garden yet, but likely garden, and he grows fresh vegetables. So they don't have any roadkill or anything like that, but they do have fresh vegetables and flowers. He tries to make life pleasant for Kit and Della. And you're very quiet. Should I go on?
Well, I'm listening. You're explaining things very well. And then the three of them sail off to Catalina Island, and they find Griff. Tell us about Griff. Yes. He's a little different from them.
Griff is an absolutely horrific person. And I think, although Hitler was not believed to be sexually motivated, Griff is definitely the Hitler in my mind. Because it was rumored when I was a child that Hitler wanted a totally Aryan race, and he would send over his blue-eyed, fair-haired young German men and make girls have children. So anyway, that's where I got Griff from. I think he was the Hitler always in my head. And Griff sails into the bay in Catalina, and they all run down to the dock. And Griff comes off the boat, and he's calling Della the N-word, thinking it's okay. Like, he's a very rough, horrible person. But he's younger than Alan, and he's good-looking. And Kit tries to flirt with him. Well, she goes to his boat. They put the three survivors... Kit, Alan, and Della put up in a hotel facing the pier, so they're very close to the beach. They put Griff in a room down the hallway, and then he wakes up and goes immediately to his boat when he takes some liquor and canned food. And then Kit visits his boat all dressed up and with makeup on and sundress and nail polish, and he rapes her. And then she realizes, and he hits her, he beats her. She's got a broken shoulder, and anyway, she goes back to the hotel, and Alan and there's another survivor they've found, who is Sherry, a young girl, a 23-year-old girl, and they hook up, Alan and Sherry, and so they look after. Alan, incidentally, is a veterinarian, so he knows a lot about anatomy, animal anatomy, but he's pretty good medically. And he sets Kit's shoulder, and she recovers, and Kit and Della is a little girl. I think she's 11 by now, or 12, and so she's growing into a young woman. She's always, there's a drugstore under the hotel, and she's always sneaking in there to get candy. And Kit and Alan are always telling her they don't want dental problems, but she keeps doing it. One night, she sneaks into the drugstore, and Griff has been watching the pair from his boat, from the pier, and he knows their habits. And so he creeps up on Della and unfortunately rapes her, because Kit is no longer available to anybody. So anyway, he does rape Della, and he's continuous. And then she gets pregnant and tells Kit. Now Kit is getting a little nicer, a little less racist. Sherry is Jewish and Della is black, and it affected Kit at first because she was so racist, she didn't like that. And then she's becoming more human. She doesn't mind anything at all. I don't think she has any racism in her bone, any bone in her body. And they eventually tell Alan, am I going a little too far, too fast, or too continuous?
No. One thing we want to make sure everyone realizes that there's a real twist in this story of the tyrant, of this world destroyer, and it's something that they're going to finally discover on the island of Hawaii, but we're not going to give that whole answer of what happens there. But this is a story that you talk about being one of the controversial aspects of your message in your book is racism, isn't it?
Well, yes, it's one of them, yes. I mean, that's Kit. It starts out with Kit. And she becomes pretty human by the end. But she really is a person that never mixed with her neighbors and was always wanting a husband who was a lawyer, always wanting him to make more money. She was greedy, and she was really a horrible person to begin with. But all the experiences tame her.
Of course, survival, another great issue in this story, not just to not just for basic living, but for control over
that's
the people that are alive, which I'm sure would happen, wouldn't it? I mean, that's a real natural aspect of that.
It certainly is, unfortunately, yes.
Yeah, so it's
human nature. Yeah.
Exactly. You have delved into an area that, of course, we don't think about very much, but with that movie 2012 that was very popular, I guess a lot of people are thinking about that kind of thing.
Well, in Los Angeles, on the freeway, the buildings that back onto the freeway say, print. 2012, you have been warned, as if it was anything we could stop or that we caused. But it is definitely something that people really dread. And I don't, actually. I just don't. After the war, there was a story going around that the world was going to end at a certain day on a certain time, and I got my mother on the phone. I was so terrified. And then when the time went by, I think it was about 4:20 on a certain day, my mother said, "You see, it didn't happen, did it?" So, but it is, people do dread the end of the world. And it is a topic right now, which is getting closer and closer. 2012, I think it was, someone said December the 21st.
I think that is right. Right. Yeah. It's a December date. Well, World War II, and obviously the attack by Hitler on England, on London, where you lived, left a profound impact on you.
It certainly did, and I didn't really know how deeply it was buried, to tell you the truth. In fact, I didn't remember at the time when I started writing Ashes. It wasn't until many years later that someone had really asked me deeply, "How was it you thought of that disaster, Noel?" And I thought about that deeply, and I thought, that's what it was. It was me always thinking the world was going to end.
Right.
I was so sure it would, Steve. I was sure it would. But there you go.
Well,
that's what
Ashes is this kind of fiction with this catastrophic kind of apocalyptic kind of theme, and you have woven the story very well, Audrey. Tell us how to get your book.
Barnes & Noble, Borders, my website, AudreyPayton.com. It's on the internet. My book, Facebook, or Google. I think, yes, it can be Googled, yes. And I'm really not a very internet person. I'm just always writing fiction.
People can order it online.
Right,
people can order it online at any of the online retail stores. So,
Well,
we appreciate you being with us, Audrey, to give us some insights into your book. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Steve. Thank you.
That was Audrey Payton. She is the author of her book, Ashes. This special interview for Indie Book Publishing is brought to you by Author Hive Publication.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.